Couch Potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Today's new movies include Tomb Raider, Love, Simon, 7 Days in Entebbe, and I Can Only Imagine. I'll also be talking about the news, Trailer Park, box office predictions, and the home cinema roundup featuring Justice League and a look back at the original Lara Croft Tomb Raider with Angelina Jolie. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
First, I want to pay my respects to Stephen Hawking. And while he wasn't an actor, he had such an impact as a public figure and a pop culture figure. And he did show up in actually a kind of a surprising number of movie and television related stuff. Now, he passed away this week at age 76 on March 14th on Pi Day. He had ALS, which is a debilitating disease that you only usually get 2 years to live. That's the prognosis when you get diagnosed with it. But he ended up living 50 some years, which is fantastic. And he was such an inspiration to people, not just scientists, but just anybody. You know, here is somebody who was stricken with one of the most debilitating diseases ever that's going to cripple you and kind of put you in the shell. And he made the most of it. Now, of course, his story was told in The Theory of Everything, which came out a couple years ago, starring Eddie Redmayne and Felicity Jones. And that was a fantastic movie because it showed the struggles he had to go through and, you know, the good and the bad that come with it. I mean, everybody is a shade of gray. And so he had good things and bad things, but he also showed up in some other pop culture shows. He showed up in Star Trek, The Next Generation. He was playing like poker with Einstein and Data. And there was, of course, The Big Bang Theory. He showed up in, I mean, they used the voice several times, but I think they had him actually show up in the show. He also wrote the book A Brief History of Time, which I remember reading back in the 90s. And it's a really good book. I mean, talk about taking some really heady physics and bringing it down to a layman's level. It's still a little bit hard to deconstruct if you don't know much about physics, but it's still a fantastic book to read. And then, of course, Errol Morris did a documentary on The Brief History of Time, which talked about the theories and the mathematics and the physics. But it also talked about his history, which I thought it's a brilliant movie. If you've never seen A Brief History of Time, the movie, it serves as a great junction between his theories and his own personal life before you can watch something like The Theory of Everything. So Stephen Hawking, Godspeed. In other news, we have Danny Boyle is going to be directing Bond 25, and I couldn't be happier about this. I know there's a bunch of people who are like, oh, Christopher Nolan. Christopher Nolan's way too serious and morose and heavy. I think a Christopher Nolan Bond movie would be a disaster. I mean, it would look good and it would have certainly a bombastic appearance. Danny Boyle can direct characters, likable characters, and he understands how to work emotion. And one of the things that's brilliant about Danny Boyle, he's not pigeonholed as any kind of director. He doesn't direct dramas or comedies or science fiction or horror. He directs everything. You look at his filmography and it's a different movie every time. Everything from, you know, even his lesser stuff like Millions all the way to Steve Jobs, which are ones that no one remembers because they weren't the big critical and box office hits. But I can't wait. I'm really excited for a Danny Boyle James Bond movie. There's another piece that I thought was really interesting. There's this new website going to be starting up called Cherry Picks, and it's put together by an actress, and I recognized her from a couple credits, and a writer. And what it's meant to do is it's meant to aggregate female critics only. And it's a response to the fact that Rotten Tomatoes, the majority of critics on Rotten Tomatoes are men. And I understand where that comes from. I think it's a dumb idea. I don't think it's going to take off. First of all, I saw somebody in an article writing about this said Rotten Tomatoes is the most trusted. I'm like, it's not trusted. Rotten Tomatoes is the most referenced because it's the easiest one you can divine a score from. Their tomato meter, they set that up 20 years ago and it just works really well. And people can say, oh, it's got 58% on Rotten Tomatoes. It's got 12% on Rotten Tomatoes. But there's no real substance to just that rating. And there's a lot of reasons that the numbers can fluctuate. It works. And it's real simple. I mean, it's an up or down rating, even if they can put like 5 stars or 1 star on there. But the idea of having a female-only critic site, I'm not offended by it. I'm not triggered by it. I just think it's a dumb idea. I think it's getting some play now in the press because it fits this narrative that is out there. But ultimately, I really don't think it's, I don't think anyone's going to care. I mean, unless it's a movie like every now and then it'll be referenced. If it actually manages to stay alive, it'll be referenced when you have a movie like, well, even Lady Bird doesn't count because Lady Bird had a fantastic Rotten Tomatoes score. So it's not like you're going to get a better score with that. So, you know, it's like Wrinkle in Time. I saw somebody had said, well, you know, there's like a 42% of male critics and 49% of female critics. That was the rating. So, I mean, yeah, there's a slight number shift, but I don't know. I just think this is more for the narrative than anything else. And speaking of narrative, you got to be careful that your narrative isn't steamrolling over the facts. For example, I saw Tessa Thompson, who is best known now for playing Valkyrie in Thor Ragnarok. Somebody had written an article on like Variety or Hollywood Reporter or something, and it was talking about how Red Sparrow was kind of a disappointment. It said, if Jennifer Lawrence can't open a movie, who can? And Tessa Thompson retweeted that and said, what about Lupita Nyong'o? And I'm like, really? Seriously? No, look, just because Lupita Nyong'o has been in big movies, I mean, she was in Star Wars and Jungle Book, but you never actually saw her because she was mo-capped through the whole thing. And she was in Black Panther. Yeah, so she's got big movies under her belt, but nobody went and saw Star Wars because they're like, oh, Lupita Nyong'o, I'm a huge fan. I better go see. I wouldn't see it otherwise. People saw Star Wars because it was Star Wars. I love Lupita Nyong'o. I think she's beautiful. I think she's talented. I think she's formidable. I don't think she's necessarily a draw. I mean, if she were, then Queen of Katwe would have been a massive monster hit, but it wasn't. I don't think she's got that star power that you're looking in terms of opening a film the way, and if you want to take somebody of color, Will Smith still has it. That's why Bright did so well on Netflix, and something like The Cloverfield Project struggled a little bit. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is Chappaquiddick opens in just a couple weeks on April 6th.
We have a situation here on Chappaquiddick.
There's been an accident. We can't find Mary Jo.
I was driving.
Do you have any idea? Court of public opinion will have your head on a stake.
We tell the truth, or at least our version of it.
I want you to know that every effort possible was made to save her.
What do we do to help the senator?
A dead body holds a lot of secrets. Those can be the difference between guilt and innocence.
Are you saying that there's a possibility that maybe she didn't drown?
We all know the name Chappaquiddick, which is such an odd name, but it took down Ted Kennedy. I'll be curious to see where this goes. I'll be curious to see where the politics lays on this one. Because, I mean, Ted Kennedy was a sleazebag whose actions ended up resulting in the death of a woman. I mean, the trailer paints a lot of the characters in there as, of course, his supporters, which of course were the people in his inner circle. I'm curious to see sort of where the politics lies on this one. So I'm interested to see this one. The other one I want to talk about is Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald, which opens on November 16th.
I have some questions for you, Professor.
This is a surprise.
There's a rumor that Newt Scamander is headed to Paris. I know he's working under your orders. What do you have to say for yourself, Dumbledore?
If you'd ever had the pleasure to teach him, you'd know Newt is not a great follower of orders.
Second Fantastic Beasts movie actually looks really kind of interesting. I the first one I was sort of lukewarm on because they really kind of stumbled into sort of introducing, and that's probably a problem with David Yates because he struggled with Harry Potter Part 5. Because that one just was sort of all set up, and Fantastic Beasts number one was a setup. This one looks like there's actually something going to be happening in it, and neat that we're going to be seeing Dumbledore. So I like the idea of going into a bigger world of the Wizarding World. So this one I'm looking forward to. Hopefully it's better than the first. And that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about 7 days in Entebbe, and I can only imagine. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's start off with the movie reviews with a historical drama, 7 Days in Entebbe. This docudrama follows a 70s-era hijacking of an Air France flight that landed in Uganda with hundreds of hostages and the Israeli response to it.
Everybody, this is a hijack situation!
We call upon revolutionary movements everywhere
to focus the attention of the world on the Palestinian people's struggle.
Welcome to Entebbe, Uganda.
There are 239 hostages at Entebbe. 83 are Israeli.
The Germans separated the Jews.
We have to act. There could be no negotiations with terrorists.
I was, of course, alive during this. I think it was 76 when this happened. I was like 5. So I don't remember this happening at all. This is a blind spot in my history. So the two-state solution in Israel has been a source of contention ever since it was adopted. And it resulted in, you know, Palestine not being too happy with the land and the area that was given to Israel. And Israel, you know, of course, holding on to that. What's interesting about this movie is it shows sort of the mindset of the Palestinians and the Israelis at the time. It also shows how weirdly easy it was to hijack a plane in the 70s. And I don't know how accurate this was, but the hijacking, they just kind of grabbed guns out of their duffel bag. I'm like, how'd you get those on a plane? They had metal detectors back in the 70s. And at the very least, people had like machine guns. I don't know how you got those on a plane, but they did. I mean, it's a real hijacking. And then they go to Uganda. They took the plane, the farthest a plane that had been hijacked had ever gone. And it goes to Uganda. Now, if you don't know anything about the history of it, Uganda was controlled by Idi Amin. And if you get your history from movies, go watch The Last King of Scotland and you'll find out what an absolute insane monster he was. So this hijacked plane, which was full of Israelis and Jews. Two of the people that were in charge of the hijacking were Germans, played by Rosamund Pike and Daniel Brühl. And of course, here you are in the 70s. You're only 30 years from World War II. And a lot of people are pointing out, like, there's a scene in there where, you know, they get the hostages and they're in this sort of this dilapidated part of an airport in Uganda. And they're separating the Jews and any Israeli citizens from the rest of the people of the Air France flight. And people are saying, you can't have Germans separating the Jews. You can't have that happening because it leaves a bad taste in everyone's mouth and it's not going to win you any points from a PR standpoint. So I think that's it. That's an interesting story. I mean, now it's less, it's still going to be an issue, of course, if you have, you know, Germans and Jews are still working through their problems. But at this point, the sort of like the generations have passed into history on that. But this was very fresh. And in fact, there was a woman who was from, it was on the flight, who was in a concentration camp. And I thought that's one of the more interesting things, is showing this weird, delicate balance that these people were trying to do because they didn't want to be overly violent, crazy terrorists. But, you know, unfortunately, when you hijack a plane and fly to Uganda with Idi Amin, that goes with the territory. Now, of course, the most interesting thing I found in this movie is how they have the Israelis deal with it. And of course, you had Yitzhak Rabin as the leader, as the prime minister, and you had his cabinet. And I found it really interesting that they're sort of their backroom discussions of what they can do. It reminds me a little bit of the movie Zero Dark Thirty. Obviously, totally different subject matter, but you're talking about people in rooms trying to figure out how to do something and get it done in a military fashion with the least amount of casualties possible. And I thought that's the most interesting part of it. And they have a really good cast, particularly, Pike and Brühl do a fine job. But you like Eddie Marsden as one of the cabinet members, and he's fantastic in it. Now, of course, there's also Benjamin Netanyahu is a character in this, because he was actually involved in this as a young soldier, is one of the squad that goes in. And it's kind of an odd sort of international look to this, because, of course, Benjamin Netanyahu is facing corruption charges right now. This has been going on for a while with him. So that's a weird period at the end of the movie, because they have to point out who Benjamin Netanyahu was and how this had affected him. But he's not like a revered leader right now. He's embroiled in some problems. The movie's a great slice of international politics that most people don't remember. It does have some struggles, as most docudramas do, getting into the third act, trying to maintain a narrative flow. And there's some weird artistic elements to it, like theatrical artistic elements, dance elements, because they have Netanyahu's girlfriend is a dancer, and they weave this in, and that's really distracting. And it has a way where it could be a really wham bang exciting ending with like Zero Dark 30 thing, but then they cut away to a lot of, you know, dance, this sort of artistic dance, and I understand what he's doing artistically with that. It just doesn't work, and so there are some issues with it, especially in the last half of the movie. But also, the last half can be the most powerful. But it's a neat movie. It's an interesting film. It's worth checking out. I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. The next movie I want to talk about is I Can Only Imagine. Now, this was not screened, so I haven't seen it, so I can't tell you about. I can only imagine what the movie's like. But here is the trailer. This film tells a story behind the wildly popular Christian rock single of the same name and how it was inspired by the death of the writer's father.
When I was 11 years old, life was tough.
Where's Mama?
She's gone. She don't want me no more. No! And she don't want you neither.
And I've always loved music. And I found some songs that I held on to. They gave me hope.
Mercy me, that can't be his real voice.
Because I needed it.
Dad, I can do this.
No, you can't!
I don't listen to a lot of pop music, just on the radio, so I had never heard this song. I'm not a huge fan of Christian rock. It has nothing to do with the message, I think. First of all, any criticism I'm going to have here has nothing to do with Christianity. I'm not like knocking Christianity. I think Christianity is great. I'm just not a fan of Christian rock. I've never been a fan of Christian rock. And that's an opinion. That's a taste issue. I think it has this sound and feel that's not terribly unique, that kind of all sounds the same. It's sort of like how I sometimes will go after, you know, faith-based movies because their production value is not very good and they look like Hallmark films. And when they don't look like that, I actually give them a good nod and I make a point to say something. But that's a part of my problem with Christian rock. I'm just not a fan of it. And I listened to the song. Finally, I went back and listened to the song I Can Only Imagine. And I understand a lot of people love this song. I don't think it's a good song. I'm going to go on the record. I think it's kind of a middle-of-the-road, meh song. I don't think, from a theological perspective, it's not even the top of the iceberg. It's like the patch of snow on the top of the iceberg. It's the flakes of snow on that patch of snow on the top of the iceberg. There's no depth to it. It has the depth of Christmas Shoes, which I hate, if you know me at all, in my Christmas music. I hate Christmas Shoes because it is the most literal and unimaginative and shallow representation of Jesus that you're going to get. And I feel that this is kind of the same thing with this song. And I know people love it. I am not one of them. So look at this movie and I'm like, at least the production value looks good. It's done by the people who did Mom's Night Out, which was a decent film, actually. But this one sort of forgoes the wacky comedy of Mom's Night Out and tries to get real. And you know, Dennis Quaid's in it. I like Dennis Quaid, but I think he's collecting a paycheck for this one. I don't know. I didn't see it, so it could be wonderful. But for right now, I'm going to have to say it gets a preemptive suck.
It sucks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Tomb Raider and Love, Simon. Because we can't. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Tomb Raider. Alicia Vikander stars as Lara Croft in this reboot of the video game turned movie franchise about an heir to a fortune looking for her father.
I think I know where my dad went.
That's right in the middle of the Devil's Sea.
It'll be an adventure.
Death is not an adventure.
Seven years. I've been on this island. Your father, he put me here. Now I see the likeness, intelligence, the recklessness.
I'm going to talk a little bit about the Lara Croft Tomb Raider film from 2001, But I'm going to talk about that in the next segment. Let's focus on this one. I'll get a little bit of comparison, but in particular, there's a lot to say about that first movie. First of all, though, this is a video game movie. It's actually, if you look back to the original Lara Croft Tomb Raider that came out in 2001, it's one of the few video game movies that actually did well. They continue to make movies based on video games, but as in track record wise, they don't do well. And there's a reason for it. And I mean, it's not just because of like Super Mario Brothers, where that one, I think somebody just took drugs and made a movie. There's like some big ones that do well, stuff like the original Mortal Kombat and Resident Evil and Lara Croft Tomb Raider with Angelina Jolie. But in general, they struggle to make it to the big screen. And there's a reason for that. And that is because video games are premise-based. And they're very open-ended. My son plays Far Cry. And that is a kind of a neat idea and a neat premise, but it's very open-ended and there's all these different branches that you can go through. And whereas a movie's plot and character-driven. And you can't just send people through the workings of the game because the game is just a bunch of challenges. Like Mortal Kombat, they put the story of these characters learning to go through Mortal Kombat. And it wasn't just people fighting for 2 hours. In Resident Evil, they had the premise of the Umbrella Corporation creating these zombies. And then it just, they put characters into the zombie film. And that's why that one worked. And Tomb Raider, they basically take, in this movie, they take the premise of the game where she's, this heir to this fortune and she's trying to track down her father and her father's work. But they do kind of like a Batman Begins thing where it's her at the beginning. She's unrefined. She's a bike courier at the beginning, but she's very smart and she's educated, but she hasn't done any tomb raiding yet. And so this is her first chance to tomb. So she's unrefined and she's not, doesn't quite have her footing and she doesn't know how to deal with certain things. And, you know, she's not all decked out with equipment, you know, that there's some growth here. And that's actually why this works from a character perspective. Now, don't misconstrue that as saying it's an incredible character drama, because it's not. I mean, it's a toss-away action movie, which is fine. I mean, there's nothing wrong with an enjoyable action movie, but it's not goofy. They try to set it in some form of the real world. If you watch, like, the Indiana Jones movies, even though they're over the top, and even though there's a supernatural element with the Ark of the Covenant or whatever, most of the stuff, quote unquote, could happen. It's actually somebody going through a real world situation. It's not, you're not fighting, you know, giant statues and stuff like that, which did happen in the first movie. So that is what makes this movie kind of work. And there's a little bit more of a grittiness to it, but not in like an overly gritty way. It's just still, it's a good solid little fun jungle adventure. It has Walton Goggins as the bad guy and he's fantastic. I love Walton Goggins. I don't think he gets enough credit. I think he's one of those people who he's sort of like a character actor who very few people know who he is until they see him and then they recognize him. He's got an incredibly recognizable face and hairline and forehead, but he's fantastic in this movie as the bad guy. And of course you've got Alicia Vikander, who's, you know, physically very different than Angelina Jolie and physically different than Tomb Raider. My son showed me this picture that he found online of the evolution of the Tomb Raider Lara Croft character. And just the shape of her breasts get weird and get enormous at one point, and then they dial it back because it did sort of become this absurd fantasy. And I mean, she'd topple over. She looks ridiculous in these games. And Alicia Vikander, she's not tiny. I mean, she's like 5'5". My wife's 5'5". But she's not like statuesque, and she's not like formidable as in being really imposing. She's kind of small, and they work with that, and they don't overpad her chest or anything like that. They don't make her into a caricature, and that's kind of good because it allows her to just be a character and develop a hero as opposed to becoming sort of a caricature from a video game. I mean, it gets very predictable at times. It gets goofy. There's some stuff that doesn't quite work. But for that jungle adventure, I think it's totally fine. I enjoyed it. I mean, I tend to like jungle adventure movies, but I mean, there are some that are really bad. Even talk like stuff like The Phantom is a bad jungle adventure movie. This one is kind of fun. And yes, there's a tomb for her to raid. It gets a little bit on the nose at times, but overall, I enjoyed it. I had a good time. I'm going to say that Tomb Raider kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Love, Simon. This is based on a best-selling book about a high school kid who struggles with letting everybody know he's gay after an anonymous classmate admits the same thing online.
My name's Simon. For the most part, my life is totally normal. I have a family that I actually like, and there's my friends. We do everything friends do. We drink way too much diced coffee, we walk gorging on carbs. So, I'm just like you, except I have one huge secret. Nobody knows I'm gay.
Have you seen the new post? About the closeted gay kid at school.
What?
Who do you think it is?
Can I call you back? Dear Blue, I'm just like you.
This is one of those movies that I think is directly relevant to kids in high school these days, right around a teenage or slightly older, maybe slightly younger. That's who I think it's going to connect best with. I mean, ultimately, it's a sweet movie, and it's kind of told with a John Hughes perspective. You know, John Hughes would make these movies that were ultimately comedies, and they were lighthearted, and they usually had some sort of romance to them, but they also had some very heavy moments, and they actually had some, they got really real at times. I mean, like The Breakfast Club is the ultimate John Hughes movie. That's one that's kind of an uproarious comedy at times, but it gets really real, and it strips away into the emotion of a high school kid, and that's why that's such a good movie. And I think this one does that as well. The acting's fine, and the characters are fine, and the direction is fine. My biggest struggle with this movie, and it's not even like a criticism of it, it's just, it's not of my generation. And that's why I say it's very targeted to this generation. 'Cause nowadays, it's a lot easier to come out nowadays. I mean, you still get bullying and you still get people who cause problems. But I mean, I got kids and they're in high school. And just the general attitude of a school system, your average school system and the kids at school to LGBT kids is drastically different than it was when I was a kid. And that's good. I mean, society has moved to a much more accepting world, and that's a good thing. And I mean, I know kids who are gay and lesbian and trans. I mean, I know, and there's real struggles that they just have to deal with certain things. But it's easier to cope in today's world. In the 80s, which is when I grew up, this was near impossible. I mean, I can't even imagine what a struggle it was. I mean, I've talked to some of my gay friends about what it was like dealing with that, you know, in the 80s and 90s, and it was not easy. I mean, in this movie, like, you know, the kids are cool with it, the teachers are cool with it, the parents are cool with it. There's two bullies in the school, and they're kind of marginalized anyway. They're just rare. And so I'm like, it's like the safest space coming out movie. And I guess that's good because it shows that we've, I guess, advanced culturally and as a society. But it seems almost foreign to me. And I do think that even today, it's not as easy in this. I mean, in this one, he's just like, there's one scene where he thinks this one kid is the one who posted. And he says to him, he's like, is that you? And he's like, yeah, no, it's not me. Is everything cool? Whereas in the 80s, if you would have done that, the kid would have probably punched him. Because that's how people dealt with it back then. So, I mean, it's good that this movie is relevantly showing us a relatively safe space. But it just was odd for me to watch. I think it's going to be much more impactful to a person of a younger generation, teenage years. But I'm still going to say that Love, Simon kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to look at the original Lara Croft Tomb Raider, talk about the box office, and go into the home cinema roundup featuring Justice League. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. I'm going to go do a bit of a throwback review. So we're continuing with the movie reviews, but I'm going to talk about an older film, and that is the original Lara Croft Tomb Raider. Angelina Jolie stars as treasure hunter Lara Croft, who searches the globe for a powerful artifact.
You're quite an authority on things ancient and mythological.
That's why I travel.
It's an ancient clock. It was hidden in a secret room. It glows, but it's getting brighter. Like it's counting down to something.
You can build, destroy, move back and forth through time.
The future
is yours now, Lara. You're the only one with the strength to destroy the power of the light. We can be partners.
You might try to kill me.
I'm not going
to
kill you.
I said you'd try.
Whenever there's a remake or a reboot, I do like to go back and rewatch the original. I think that's fun to do. You know, especially if it's a movie I don't quite remember all that much. I mean, if they were to remake, I mentioned The Breakfast Club in the last segment, God forbid, if anyone ever remade The Breakfast Club, I wouldn't have to go back and rewatch The Breakfast Club because I've seen it enough recently. I mean, that it's still very fresh in my mind. But I saw Lara Croft Tomb Raider. I think I saw it on DVD. DVD was relatively new back then. I saw it on DVD like when it first hit home video. So it's been like 15, 16 years since I've seen that. And I remember seeing the sequel in the theaters and it was awful. But this one, especially comparing it, I saw it on my way home from seeing the new one. We got it and watched it at home. And the first thing I noticed with this one is this one does not hold up. And yes, part of it's the goofy turn of the century digital effects that just look like garbage. I guess they looked good back then, but they look terrible now. They're not refined at all, and they look all like this. It all looks like liquid metal from the Terminator 2. Oh, it's not good. It's really a wonky presentation of the effects. The other thing is this movie makes no sense whatsoever. I watched this whole thing, and I'm like, I don't even know what they're going after. It's like, they go overboard with the Illuminati. And yeah, I guess this is part of the game. And this is the struggle that they have with video game adaptations. If you remember Warcraft could have been a really cool movie, but they had so many different stories, lines, and characters, and this happening and that battle, because they needed to pay service to all the elements of Warcraft. But Warcraft is incredibly complex, and you needed to distill it down to just a much smaller story. And this one, same thing. I think they made it too big. And the other thing is, it just rips off the Matrix so much. It literally has her doing wire work exercises and then running on the ceiling and stuff like that. It plays almost identical Matrix music. It's, you know, came out 2 years after the Matrix. It's heavily influenced by the Matrix. And that's one of the things I liked about this new Tomb Raider, that this one, she is an expert at all the stuff that she can do from the first part of the movie. There's no growth in her character. Her character doesn't change whatsoever. She doesn't get better at what she does. She doesn't discover anything about herself or anybody else. She just raids a tomb. And there's also some weird elements. Like, it has Chris Berry as the butler, and he's from Red Dwarf. I'm a big Red Dwarf fan. And it's odd to see him, and it's sad to see him, because this is really the only other thing outside of Red Dwarf that Chris Berry ever did that's really noticeable in pop culture. So it's, you know, I wish he had a bigger career, which he doesn't. The other thing I noticed about this one is it had Daniel Craig in it long before he played Bond. This was several years before he was even cast as Bond. They were getting ready to make Die Another Day still at that point. So Pierce Brosnan had yet to make his final Bond. So, but Daniel Craig, a young Daniel Craig playing an American who does a terrible American accent. I don't know if Angelina Jolie does a good British accent, because I'm not British. This is nonsensical. And while I thought it was fun, back then, it doesn't hold up. And all Angelina Jolie, she just poses. Every single scene is her posing. And it's just all eye candy, but it's like PG-13 eye candy. It's sort of pointless. So I'm going to have to say the original Lara Croft Tomb Raider. Sorry, Angelina Jolie fans, but it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk really quick about the box office. Last week, there was a big milestone for Black Panther. It was the fourth weekend. It was at number one, and it did extremely well. It beat out A Wrinkle in Time. A Wrinkle in Time did not do well. It did it pretty much on par with what people were expecting, including Disney. Some people were saying it was going to do better, but $33 million is about what it made. Black Panther made just under $41 million. Strangers Pray at Night overperformed with about $10.5 million, even though it got like a garbage cinema score. It was like C-. Hurricane Heist barely made it into the top 10 with 3, and Gringo didn't even reach the top 10. Now, Wrinkle in Time, people are saying, oh, a big disappointment. I don't know. That's pretty much what Disney was expecting. I think when you get the final numbers in from the entire run of the film, both internationally and in America, And then when you throw in video and stuff, it's still going to be breaking even. Just barely cost more than $100 million. So I think it's going to end up making all that up when all is said and done. It's going to go into the black. But, of course, the big question is, will Tomb Raider beat Black Panther? We're going to see. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Just got to give a little shout out to Justice League. Let's go ahead and play that trailer. Talk a little bit about the movie again, a little bit more after we've had a chance to digest it from November. Batman, Wonder Woman, The Flash, Cyborg, and Aquaman join forces to resurrect Superman in order to save the world from a supernatural attack.
The world remains in mourning after the death of Superman. Violence, acts of war, and terrorism are all on the rise.
I had a dream. It was the end of the world.
Invasion.
I think it's something more. Something darker.
Now we can look back at Justice League and see how well it did. It was not a huge hit. Its domestic total was about $230 million. Internationally, it made $660 million, and it ended up breaking even. I know there were people that were just hoping that it would die. But it ended up crossing. I think it was like somewhere like under between $550 million and $600 million was the estimate of what it needed to make to break even. So it was a profitable movie. It just wasn't this massive juggernaut that the other movies were, or what they were hoping. They were hoping for another Avengers, and they didn't get it. And when you look at it's the lowest performing of all of the DC Extended Universe movies. So there is a rate of attrition from Man of Steel through Batman. Let's take Wonder Woman out, since that's sort of an aberration. From Man of Steel through Batman versus Superman to Justice League, it's the lowest performing of them, both domestic and worldwide. So it's around par with what Man of Steel made worldwide, and that was 5 years ago. So this was not a big win for Warner Brothers, but it wasn't a disaster. And overall, I think it's a fine movie. It's fun. It's not cohesive, but I think that has a lot to do with the fact that they were back-ending a story and rushing the putting together of all these. They all needed their own movie to begin with. And you didn't actually find out a working formula until you got to Wonder Woman. And by that time, Justice League is pretty much wrapped. You know, I think they could have done a standalone Batman movie, another standalone Superman movie. And they've been trying to get farther and farther away that overly grim, dour look of Man of Steel, that I want to be Batman, I want to be the Dark Knight type movies. All that Christopher Nolan influence that came from the previous three Batman movies, and the fact that he produced Man of Steel, and the fact that he helped work on conceptualizing it, and then Christopher Nolan, I think, infected the Superman series too soon, and that's not what people wanted. People wanted what Wonder Woman became. And if they had started with Wonder Woman, they would. So this is a stumbling of the films. But it's out on Blu-ray and DVD, and, you know, it's still an enjoyable movie. I think it's going towards what it needs to be, but I think some people were burned by Man of Steel and Batman versus Superman, and, you know, Aquaman, who knows, maybe Aquaman will be good, but I'm seeing set photos that are leaking online for the new Shazam movie, and that looks like it's going away from this overly designed, the hyper designed look that Justice League had. So, you know, we'll see. I this did not turn out to be something that Warner Brothers wanted it to be, but I still thought it was a perfectly fine movie. And it's worth checking out again on Blu-ray and DVD. So I'm going to have to say Justice League still kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
The other movies that are out this week on DVD and Blu-ray include The Shape of Water, The Disaster Artist, I, Tonya, Ferdinand, and Call Me By Your Name. And that is it for this week. I need to go. Have a good week. Happy St. Patrick's Day weekend to everybody. Aaron Gobra, and we will see you guys next week. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.